While the British colonel set Lazaro's broken arm and mixed plaster for the cast, the German major translated out loud passages from Howard W. Campbell Jr.'s monograph. Campbell had been a fairly well-known playwright at one time. His opening line was this one. America is the wealthiest nation on earth, but its people are mainly poor, and poor Americans are urged to hate themselves. To quote the American humorist Kin Hubbard, "It ain't no disgrace to be poor, but it might as well be." It is in fact a crime for an American to be poor, even though America is a nation of poor. Every other nation has folk traditions of men who were poor, but extremely wise and virtuous, and therefore more estimable than anyone with power and gold. No such tales are told by the American poor. They mock themselves and glorify their betters. The meanest eating or drinking establishment owned by a man who is himself poor is very likely to have a sign on its wall asking this cruel question: "If you're so smart, why ain't you rich?" There will also be an American flag, no larger than a child's hand, glued to a lollipop stick and flying from the cash register. The author of the monograph, a native of Schenectady, New York, was said by some to have the highest IQ of all the war criminals who were made to face a death by hanging. So it goes. Americans, like human beings everywhere, believe many things that are obviously untrue, the monograph went on. Their most destructive untruth is that it is very easy for any American to make money. They will not acknowledge how, in fact, hard money is to come by, and therefore those who have no money blame and blame and blame themselves. This inward blame has been a treasure for the rich and powerful, who have had to do less for their poor, publicly and privately, than any other ruling class since, say, Napoleonic times. Many novelties have come from America. The most startling of these, a thing without precedent, is a mass of undignified poor. They do not love one another because they do not love themselves. Once this is understood, the disagreeable behavior of American enlisted men in German prisons ceases to be a mystery. Howard W. Campbell Jr. now discussed the uniform of the American enlisted in World War II. Every other army in history, prosperous or not, has attempted to clothe even its lowliest soldiers so as to make them impressive to themselves and others as stylish experts in drinking and copulation and looting and sudden death. The American Army, however, sends its enlisted men out to fight and die in a modified business suit, quite evidently made for another man, a sterilized but unpressed gift from a nose-holding charity which passes out clothing to drunks in the slums. When a dashingly clad officer addresses such a frumpishly dressed bum, he scolds him, as an officer in any army must. But the officer's contempt is not, as in other armies, avuncular theatricality. It is a genuine expression of hatred for the poor, who have no one to blame for their misery but themselves. A prison administrator dealing with captured American enlisted men for the first time should be warned: expect no brotherly love, even between brothers. There will be no cohesion between the individuals. Each will be a sulky child who often wishes he were dead. Campbell told what the German experience with captured American enlisted men had been. They were known everywhere to be the most self-pitying, least fraternal, and dirtiest of all prisoners of war, said Campbell. They were incapable of concerted action on their own behalf. They despised any leader from among their own number, refused to follow or even listen to him, on the grounds that he was no better than they were, that he should stop putting on airs. And so on. Billy Pilgrim went to sleep, woke up as a widower in his empty home in Ilium. His daughter Barbara was reproaching him for writing ridiculous letters to the newspapers. "Did you hear what I said?" Barbara inquired. It was 1968 again. Of course. He had been dozing. "If you're going to act like a child, maybe we'll just have to treat you like a child." "That isn't what happens next," said Billy. We'll see what happens next. Big Barbara now embraced herself. It's awfully cold in here. Is the heat on? The heat? The furnace? The thing in the basement? The thing that makes hot air that comes out of these registers? I don't think it's working. Maybe not. Aren't you cold? I hadn't noticed. Oh my God, you are a child. If we leave you alone here, you'll freeze to death. You'll starve to death. And so on. It was very exciting for her, taking his dignity away in the name of love. Barbara called the oil burner man, and she made Billy go to bed, made him promise to stay under the electric blanket until the heat came on. She set the control of the blanket at the highest notch, which soon made Billy's bed hot enough to bake bread in. When Barbara left, slamming the door behind her, Billy traveled in time to the zoo in Tralfamador again. A mate had just been brought to him from Earth. She was Montana Wildhack, a motion picture star. Montana was under heavy sedation. Tralfamadorians wearing gas masks brought her in, put her on Billy's yellow lounge chair, withdrew through his airlock. The vast crowd outside was delighted. All attendance records for the zoo were broken. Everybody on the planet wanted to see the Earthling's mate. Montana was naked, and so was Billy, of course. He had a tremendous wang, incidentally. You never know who'll get one. Now she fluttered her eyelids. Her lashes were like buggy whips. "Where am I?" she said. "Everything is all right," said Billy gently. "Please don't be afraid." Montana had been unconscious during her trip from Earth. The Tralfamadorians hadn't talked to her, hadn't shown themselves to her. The last thing she'd remembered was sunning herself by a swimming pool in Palm Springs, California. Montana was only 20 years old. Around her neck was a silver chain with a heart-shaped locket hanging from it, between her breasts. Now she turned her head to see the myriads of Tralfamadorians outside the dome. They were applauding her by opening and closing their little green hands quickly. Montana screamed and screamed. All the little green hands closed tight because Montana's terror was so unpleasant to see. The head zookeeper ordered a crane operator, who was standing by, to drop a navy blue canopy over the dome, thus simulating Earthling night inside. Real night came to the zoo for only one Earthling hour out of every 62. Billy switched on the floor lamp. The light from the single source threw the baroque detailing of Montana's body into sharp relief. Billy was reminded of fantastic architecture in Dresden before it was bombed. In time, Montana came to love and trust Billy Pilgrim. He did not touch her until she made it clear that she wanted him to. After she had been on Tralfamador for what would have been an Earthling week, she asked him shyly if he wouldn't sleep with her, which he did. It was heavenly. And Billy traveled in time from that delightful bed to a bed in 1968. It was his bed in Ilium, and the electric blanket was turned up high. He was drenched in sweat, remembered groggily that his daughter had put him to bed, had told him to stay there until the oil burner was repaired. Somebody was knocking on his bedroom door. "Yes?" said Billy. "Oil burner man." "Yes?"
"It's running good now. Heat's coming up."
"Good."
"Mouse ate through a wire from the thermostat."
"I'll be darned." Billy sniffed. His hot bed smelled like a mushroom cellar. He had had a wet dream about Montana Wildhack. On the morning after that wet dream, Billy decided to go back to work in his office in the shopping plaza. Business was booming as usual. His assistants were keeping up with it nicely. They were startled to see him. They had been told by his daughter that he might never practice again. But Billy went into his examining room briskly, asked that the first patient be sent in. So they sent him one, a 12-year-old boy who was accompanied by his widowed mother. They were strangers, new in town. Billy asked them a little about themselves, learned that the boy's father had been killed in Vietnam in the famous five-day battle for Hill 875 near Dak Tho. So it goes. While he examined the boy's eyes, Billy told him matter-of-factly about his adventures on Tralfamador, assured the fatherless boy that his father was very much alive still in moments the boy would see again and again. "Isn't that comforting?" Billy asked. And somewhere in there, the boy's mother went out and told the receptionist that Billy was evidently going crazy. Billy was taken home. His daughter asked him again, "Father, father, father, what are we going to do with you?"